The jury system works the same way. If there's a jury trying to deliberate if somebody robbed a bank, and the prosecuting attorney says, well, here's the bank's video. We have six witnesses that he robbed the bank. The teller recognizes this man. On the way out of robbing the bank, he cut his finger while running out the door, and we have a DNA matches him. The money was found in the trunk of his car with his fingerprints all over it. The jury says, guilty. How could they say guilty? Maybe the DNA is a mistake. It's his twin brother. Maybe the teller is making a mistake. Maybe the witnesses aren't sure. The money in his trunk, maybe he's being framed. How could the jury say guilty and send him to prison? Because the judge told them ahead of time that you don't have to have beyond a shadow of a doubt. The judge says you have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. When somebody is beyond a reasonable doubt based on evidence, they say, I know something. I say to college students sometimes, if I do this presentation in a university, I say to them, when you applied for this university, you sent in a registration form with an application non-refundable check for $100 or $200 with your application. Did you know that the university existed? It's the Ohio State University. And you live in New York. You're never in Ohio. You're going to send a couple of $100 to an address there? Maybe it's fictitious. It's some guy collecting money. What do you mean? It's on the internet, Ohio State. That's beyond a reasonable doubt. Simcha is saying it exactly. He doesn't believe that Zion National Park exists. He knows it. He's not been there, but he knows it. And that's real, and that's a fact. Discovery says, well, you know, you could do the same thing with any piece of information. You can analyze anything to see what's the evidence. Based on the evidence, I can figure out if it's real. Even if I wasn't there in person, I can still know about something and analyze something based on evidence. We usually in discovery use the Mossad, that's the Israeli FBI, as our example. Suppose the Mossad in Israel gets a communique from their spy in Tehran. I assume the Israelis have a spy in Tehran, or two, or three, or five, or ten. And all of a sudden, they get a postcard. The postcard says, Dear Mossad. Okay. I want to make sure I have the right postcard. Dear Mossad, this is Moshe, your spy here in Tehran. The Iranians are building a nuclear facility. Come in with the F-16s and blow it up at 4 p.m. because I can get the radar down. Signed, Moshe here in Tehran. And the Israeli Mossad gets this postcard in the mail in Tel Aviv, and it's post-stamped Spring Valley, New York. What do you think the Mossad's going to do with that? Two possibilities. The garbage or the recycle bin. But they're not going to pay any attention to it. Because if it would really be their spy in Tehran, their spy would not send it on a postcard postmarked Spring Valley 10977. It would be some kind of courier system. There would be some kind of code that it's him. Maybe it would be encoded, the message. It wouldn't be so open. But if they actually did get an encoded message with a specific password or something, with some information that would really indicate it's their spy, then they pay attention to it. It's like when you call Visa or MasterCard and you want to have your balance, and they start asking you what's your name, and then they start asking you what else they ask you. Social Security number. And then they ask you your mother's maiden name and your PIN number and your pet horse's hobbies and different questions that are, what's the idea? They want to know if it's you. That same idea would be the Mossad would want to know if it's actually their spy. In fact, the Mossad says they have five ways of verifying if it's their spy. They want to have identifying information, like what we just talked about, a social security, a PIN number, something from their spy. They'd want to have a transmission process that's vastly different than a postcard. They'd want to have some encrypted courier system, some way of getting this information. They'd also want to have maybe outside verification, meaning the spy says that they're building this facility, this location, you can get the radar down. Do they have maybe a satellite photograph or some other source of information that verifies that? If they have those three things, it's from their spy. What they don't know yet is if he really has control to be able to deliver on what he says, that he can get the radar down. But if by past performance he shows he can do it, then Mossad says, yeah, we got the right information, we got to figure out what to do. Now, why am I telling you all this spy business with the Mossad on Sunday morning in Muncie and Har Sameach? Because really, the way you verify this document, this fictitious postcard, that same way you can verify any document. And if I come to a non-frum yid, or even a frum yid, and I tell him, I can show you evidence about the authorship of the Torah, and I can use the same system as the Mossad uses for evidence for their communique. I can have these four categories, and I will take a look at these four categories of evidence, and I will see if the evidence indicates who the author of the Torah is, the same way evidence indicates if this is really the authored by the spy in Tehran or a hoaxer in Spring Valley. And based on that, I can make a decision. And if there's enough evidence, Simcha already has proven to us that if you have enough evidence, you don't say, I believe, but you say, I know. And a jury says, guilty. And an audience will say yes or will say no. So we're going to look at evidence, and we're going to see what we have. And we're going to look at these four categories. Actually, and usually the order we do it is this order. Today, actually, I'm going to do outside verification and transmission. And Rabbi Yaakov Solomon, who's going to be the second speaker today, who many of you have heard of and known and written and read about what he's written and books and articles, he'll be here, Mirza Hashem, to do ID info and control. So, without further ado, I'm just going to fast forward my slides to where I want to start, where we'll talk about the first evidence of outside verification. Now let's see if this works. Yeah, good. Okay. Let's play Martian. A Martian lands on planet Earth. You meet the Martian here in Muncie. The Martian wanted to land in Brooklyn. There was no room. Martian landed in Muncie. There's still some places that are a little room for the Martian to land. You meet the Martian. The Martian tells you, show me something fantastic about planet Earth. Show me something miraculous. Where are you going to take the Martian? Har Sameach. The Martian comes in, sees the nice space medrash with the art scroll shas, with the beautiful windows, with the davening that's very hasmod, hislahavos, but he doesn't really understand it. Where else? Niagara Falls. Take the Martian to Niagara. Who's been to Niagara Falls? Everybody's been to Niagara Falls. With the kids four times, you regret it each time. You go to Niagara Falls. Martian looks at Niagara Falls. It's water falling off a building. You take the Martian to the Grand Canyon, to Bryce, big hole in the ground. Martian says, we have big holes in the ground there too. And you're walking down Route 59 with the Martian, and the Martian says to you, what's that building? And he's pointing to the Sam Hospital. And you say, that's just a hospital. And Martian says, what happens in a hospital? And you say, well, people are born there. And the Martian says, born? What's born? You say, well, you know what? Come inside and I'll show you. And you take the Martian into the maternity department, and the Martian sees the birth of a baby, which the Martian has never seen before, and the Martian says, wow, it's a mini earthling emerging from a large earthling. This is a giant miracle. Is that a miracle? Is the birth of a baby a miracle? Who says yes? Raise your hand. Rabbeisai, Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov, this miracle has already happened, Baruch Hashem, today in Muncie. Maybe two or three times already this morning. Why isn't everybody excited? It's not your miracle, huh? It's not your daughter, your son, your brother, your sister. And also, Yesterday was Mazel Tov, and the day before was Mazel Tov, and the day before that was Mazel Tov. It's a very nice thing. It's a miracle. But it happens all the time. That's the problem with miracles. When it happens all the time, it becomes like the Eden in the Midbar, 40 years, they're eating man. It comes down from the sky. After 40 years, they go into Eretz Yisrael. They see the Canaanim. The Canaanim are tilling the soil. They're cutting things that are growing. They're sifting. They're doing. What are you doing? We're breaking. We're preparing bread. And the Eden say, bread from the ground? Hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz? And the Canaanim look at them. How do you get bread? We get it the regular way. It falls from the sky. Hamotzi lechem min ha'shamayim. If for 40 years you get it like that, that becomes the biggest miracle, becomes nothing. If it would rain lemonade in Muncie, it would be in the news, it would be on the newspaper, it would be Ichweis, it would be placards and all the shuls, this epistitzich do, I don't know what they would say, if it has a heksher or not, if it's, you know, you have to see toiloyim with the lemonade, mit ha-shamayim, I don't know. But one thing I know, it would be a gewaldig gezach. And after 1 week of lemonade, mit ha-shamayim, everybody would say, okay, it's a dev teva. You know, let's see lemonade with Splenda instead of sugar. Oh, this won't be that happens. It's what you get used to. Rabbeisai, that's our problem with our own Jewish history. What's Jewish history? We started in Mitzrayim. We went 40 years in the Midbar without a GPS, so we took 40 years to get into Eretz Yisrael. We built the Beis HaMikdash, it lasted 400 years. We got exiled to Babel, came back, built another base of Mikdash, lasted 400 years, we got exiled again. To Iraq, to Iran, to Syria, to Yemen, to Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, Spain, Portugal, Germany, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Poland, Russia, Latvia, Lithuania, we came to the New World, we lived in an inner city neighborhood, we got a few dollars, we moved to the suburbs. Who lives in the suburbs? Yeah, everybody. And that's Jewish history in a nutshell. And it's normal. It's normal. We forget it's not normal. When we started in the Zman Moshe and Yahushua, there were 31 nations in Eretz Yisrael. Canaanim and Prizim and Chitim and Amalekim, and the Plishtim were gigantic. A whole time of Shmuel and Shaul and David was always more Plishtim Tzaras, and Plishtim were gigantic, and their cities still exist. Aza, Ekron, Ashkelon, but the Plishtim are gone. And Edom is gone. And the Canaanim and Chitim. And later on came Bovel, Babylonians, gone. Persians, gone. And guess who's still here? Us Yidlach, we're still here. It's a miracle, because nations come and go. National entities rise and fall. We're still here. We don't notice the miracle of ourselves, because it's like the mon in the Midbar. It's, we're here. We used to live in Borough Park, and before that in Crown Heights, and before that in Budapest. And, you know, right? No, it's normal. It's not normal. Nations come and go, they rise and fall. But if you play Martian and step back and say, how come in the whole world's history it seems the Jews are the only ones that keep on going? It becomes a giant question. You don't really need to be a Martian. When Pascal was asked by King Louis XIV, show me something miraculous in the world, Louis XIV answered four words, the Jews, your majesty. He understood that something's going on with the Jews keeping on going. In fact, there's an article written, and I have it here, a piece of the article from Mark Twain in an 1899 news article, where Mark Twain wrote, this is just a piece of it, the Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose, filled the final with sound and splendor, faded away, Greek and Roman followed, made a vast noise. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they are in twilight or have vanished. And the article continues, the Jews saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies. All things are mortal, but the Jew, all forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret? And Mark Twain wrote this in 1899. Obviously, in the last 100 plus years since 1899, we've had some Rachmana Litzlan tough times, but it's still an emes that a Yid has a certain vitality ad hayom hazeh. what gives us this koyach? What gives us this kind of eternity? That's the Martian's question. That should be our question. If we look at the Torah, again apologizing for having the quote of a pasuk in English, if we look in the Torah, Bereishis Yud Zayin Zayin, Hashem says an eternal covenant. The Hebrew, the Lashon Kodesh must be Bris Olam, Bris, I don't know, what's the pasuk say? I came with Bris Olam. To Avraham Avinu, Hashem said he's making a bris forever and ever with Avraham Avinu and his descendants, us. A Martian looks at that and says, somebody wrote a book all those years ago predicting that this nation's going to be eternal? The Martian has two questions. How is it that the Jews stick around? Number two, who wrote a book? Chalila to call the Torah a book, but for our purposes, I'm just putting it that way. Who wrote a book saying, I'm making an eternal covenant with that particular people? Chances are that people's going to be gone in 500, 600 years like most nations on earth. How could the author write eternal nation? Question about the book and the nation. Klal Yisrael and the Torah. It's odd. Now don't think this is a very far-fetched question, because the historians today grapple with this. Paul Johnson, a current non-Jewish historian, in his book History of the Jews, tries to figure out what's the secret of the Jews keeping on going. I read the book. On the last page, this is his conclusion. How do the Jews keep on going? The Jews believe they were a special people with such unanimity and passion over so long a span of time that they became one. You read it, if you know English, you say, ha, psh, I'm a Yid, look at that, I belong to the right organization. But if you look at it very carefully, you'll see this is a big question mark. Unanimity means togetherness. No. It's hard to say that we are always perfectly together. You know, we're coming up on Shavuos, and Midbarim and Zich, we exalt ourselves with the idea that at Mamad Har Sinai, it was Ke'ish Echad B'Lev Echad. Well, if to be Ke'ish Echad B'Lev Echad is such an easy thing, we wouldn't be so excited. Wow, at Mamad Har Sinai, everybody was Ke'ish Echad B'Lev Echad. What do you mean? Every day a month, see everybody's Ke'ish Echad B'Lev Echad. Evidently, it's not so easy. And the unanimity is a big question. You know, are we that together? There's a story about a discovery presenter that once was in Arizona, and he made a joke that if there are three Jews in a room, there are four opinions. And somebody in the audience says, Rabbi, the joke is if there are two Jews in a room, there are three opinions. So he said, you're proving my point. We're arguing about the joke. More than that, in the United States there's about two political parties, and in Israel there's 27 political parties. I don't know if that's unanimity. Also, the whole idea that he has, that they believe, the Jews believe they are a special people, so they become a special people. Does that work? Anybody here a doctor? Okay, I'd like to be a doctor too, but I'll do it this method. I believe I'm a doctor. I believe I'm a doctor. It says if you believe it strong enough, it happens. That's the implication here. Am I going to become a doctor like that? Chiropractor? Pharmacist? Nada. Nothing. And what about all the other nations? They believe they were temporary? Oh, we've been around 600 years. We got to fade away. So this is a cute thing, and the book is a nice book, and it's a recommended book for somebody to read history, but that's not the secret of the Jewish people. Let's take it a step back. Never mind eternal nation. Are we a nation at all? According to historians, you need three prerequisites to be a nation. What are they? What do you need to be a nation? A land you need, that's right. A common history is right. And a common language. Perfect. That's what you need. Do we have them? Where's our common land? Eretz Yisrael. Here we are, in Muncie, Eretz Yisrael, right? The answer is, we have a common land, it's Eretz Yisrael, but common land is a land that you live on continually and contiguously and keep it on going. For most of the history of Klal Yisrael, we have not been on the land. We've been away. It's only the last 100 years that a sizable percent of the Jewish people are in Eretz Yisrael. Before that, hardly anybody, for hundreds and hundreds of years. That's not common land. Common language? What would it be?
English
is the common language. Okay, that answers all the questions. But actually, it would be Lashon HaKodesh. The Torah is Lashon. But who's speaking it? We're speaking English. Our Zaydis, and maybe us even at home, speak Yiddish. If you're Sephardi, you maybe spoke Ladino. In the times of the Gemara, they spoke Aramaic. The whole Gemara is written in Aramaic. Looks like that, yeah, that original language is the language of the Torah, that we learn the Torah and the Haftorah on Shabbos and we daven, but we're not using it as a daily language. We're 0 for 2. Common history?
Yeah.
Yeah? I went to London in 1980. My cousin married a Sephardi girl in London. I came there for Shabbos. Friday night we davened, okay, pretty much the same. We came home, we made Kiddush, okay. Hamotzi, everything good. Then downhill. On the table is sitting this green soup. I figured it's a Sfaradi soup for Friday night. What do I know? I take a spoonful, put it in my mouth, and I'm burning up. It was some kind of Sfaradi thing that you take a little challah, you dip it in. You don't shovel it in your mouth. I must have killed 100,000 taste buds instantly. I'm just showing you a difference between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. And if you take the Temanim, common history? We'd have to go back 1,000 years to get our common history, Ashkenazim and Sephardim. In today's communication world, with cell phones and the internet and telephones and everything, we don't understand that for hundreds and hundreds of years, Yidden in Germany and Poland could have been, and as compared to Yidden in Syria or Yemen, could have been on different planets. A Yid in Poland 200 years ago and a Yid in Yemen 200 years ago were not in any communications. My mother, Alea Sholem, remembers to an extent, but it was hardly any kind of really connection. My mother, Alea Sholem, remembers that in her town in Poland, was this in this town, and she had a relative who lived in the next town. I asked her once, did you ever go visit her? Never go. How far was it? 10 kilometers. How much is that? 6 miles. Travel is not like today. Today I get on Muncie Trails in the morning and I'm in Manhattan in an hour. And in between I was in a different state. And I davened also on the bus. What convenience. It's a different world. We're basically 0 for 3. The Martian says, how could you be the eternal nation when you're hardly a nation at all? Big question. How about the flip side? What do nations... How do nations disappear? What happens? Any ideas? They get conquered. What happens when they get conquered?
Assimilation.
They assimilate. Why do they assimilate? Just because you get conquered, you have to assimilate?
Forced.
That's the word. Persecution. Then they assimilate. You know, the Babylonians, the Persians conquered the Babylonians. I'm not sure what year. It was before I was born. It was. And why are you laughing? The Persians conquered the Babylonians. Now the Babylonians are discriminated against. We're not giving you jobs. We don't like how you dress. We don't like the way you talk. You're different. What did the Babylonians do? Okay, we'll speak Persian. We'll send our kids to Persian schools. We'll wear Persian clothes. We'll sit on Persian rugs. Whatever is necessary. Does it work? Yeah. But in one or two generations, they are no longer Babylonians. They are now Persians. Have the Eden ever tried this?
Yes.
Yeah.
Give me a specific example.
Megillus Esther.
Megillus Esther is a good example. Germany, somebody says, is a good example. Some people tell me Spain in the 1500s. All of them are the same idea. That Eden seemed to be assimilating into the Goyish society. And something in each case came along to remind them, you are Eden, not so fast. How come? How come it doesn't work by us? By us, the biggest sorrow, Rachmana Litzlan, in Nazi Germany was that Hitler says, Rachimach Shemai, that we can't tell who's a Jew. The Jews have so infiltrated German society, we can't tell who's a Jew, because the Jews in Germany didn't look like the Jews in Poland with long beards and long jackets and big hats. They looked assimilated into the Goyish culture. So I thought if they assimilate, there's no more a threat, there's no dislike of the unlike. Somehow by the Eden it doesn't work. Why? Who's pulling the strings? Who's keeping us eternal? Sometimes the result of being conquered is being exiled. And, pardon the English, there are predictions in the Torah of Golos. If somebody will rationally think about it, how can this be? How can the same Torah, by the same author, say, you will be an eternal nation, and you will be also exiled and dispersed? Kimat, that's an impossibility, because they are opposites. Any nation that gets exiled and dispersed, besides the Eden it would seem, they end up wherever society they are, readjusting, refitting, becoming part of the other society. And Eden somehow, it doesn't happen in the end. So how would an author in ancient times write eternal nation, exiled and dispersed? In fact, even in the last 200 years, this is not a lot of color, so it's a nice slide. The last 200 years, there's been a tremendous movement of Yidden from continent to continent and country to country. We're not talking the last 2,000 or 2,500 years. We're talking the last 200 years. Now, somebody once offered the following way. It can be that you can be in Golos, in exile, dispersed, and remain eternal if wherever you go, they love you, treat you nicely, give you your own sort of semi-autonomous existence within their culture, and then efshir. So you know what I say to that? Who knows? But that has not been the Jewish experience in Golos. The Jewish experience in Golos has been always gigantic anti-Semitism. It's only now, Baruch Hashem, B'li Ayin Hara, that in the United States now, we don't see that in an overt form. But it's under the surface, and in most of our histories it wasn't under the surface, but it was clearly above the surface. Standard anti-Semitism has been, and in most of the world even today, is still the attitude of the Welt to the Jewish people. And interesting that that's also predicted, obviously, in the Torah. The Torah actually says you will be an eternal nation. The Torah also says you will be exiled and dispersed. And the Torah also says you'll be persecuted and hated. And if I'd be a Martian, which I am not in this Gilgal, then I would say, I don't understand. Who wrote this Torah expecting this to happen? And how in the world did this happen? If there was an ancient human author, the ancient human author wouldn't dare write these opposites. You want to write eternal nation? Good. Say they'll be secure and they'll be taken care of and they'll be successful on their own land and nobody will conquer them and everything's going to be gewaldic. You want to say the other side, they'll be exiled, dispersed, hated, and persecuted? That's your predictions in your sefer, in your book? Don't write eternal nation. It's not going to happen. Somehow, the ancient author wrote it, and it did happen. The evidence says that's not an ancient author like a human ancient author. That's somebody who is predicting something that is virtually impossible, and it doesn't seem to have any fear for the longevity of the document in doing it. It's not proof, but it's an indication of a divine authorship. Now, somebody once asked me, what about other nations that have been around a very, very long time? And the usual pick is the Chinese, because their calendar goes to 4,600 something years. You know, what's their secret? Maybe we have the same secret. I once at work, in my regular job, I used to have a Chinese boss, and he once asked me what year the Jews are up to, and I told him 5,700, whatever, and he said, it's impossible. I said, why? He says, the Chinese calendar is only up to 4,600 It's 1,000 years less. So I said to him, so why is it impossible? So he says, what did the Jews eat for 1,000 years? And I didn't know what to say. You know, good point. But anyway, if you didn't get the joke, ask me later. We'll go over it again at that break, you know. But maybe what's the secret of the Chinese with us? You know, maybe we have the same... How do Chinese keep on going? What's their secret?
Numbers.
1.3 billion people. Even if they get conquered, they don't feel like a persecuted minority. They are so big, they swallow up their conquerors. You could send 500,000 troops and conquer China. You think 1.3 billion people, 20-some percent of the world's population, is suddenly going to feel like a bunch of Nebuchs? They're so big, they're immovable.
Also, they're not dispersed.
The reason they're not dispersed is because of their size. Is that our secret? Obviously not. Here's actually a sort of chart of China's population growth. And here on the bottom, this line, it's not your 401k. It looks like it. But this line at the bottom is the Jewish population, which never goes anywhere. And it's predicted, as everybody knows in the Torah, Ma'at b'kol ha'amim, that we're going to be small. And the question now is more and more giant, how are we the eternal nation if we're exiled, persecuted, hated, dispersed, and few in number? And the bigger question is, who wrote a prediction thousands of years ago which is impossible to happen, and it has happened? Evidence to the Rabbeinu Shlomo. Now, there are 6.3 billion people in the world. What percent of them are Jewish? Point is a very good start. My slide says 0.002. I don't know if this is real or not. It's about 0.2%. It's really 0.2, not 0.002. 0.2. But you know what we could do and make it simple, even if you didn't finish sixth grade? Round off the Jewish world population as a percent of the Jewish population as a percent of the world's population to the nearest whole number.
Zero.
That's right. Zero. Fill out your census form, so let's get it up a little higher. But in the meantime, if you round off the Jewish population to the nearest whole percent, since the Jewish population is less than 0.5%, in fact, less than 0.25%, comes out that we are statistically zero. And being statistically zero, the whole world nevertheless knows that the Jews are supposed to be a light unto the nations. Now, you can ignore that quote. It's just from Paul Johnson's History of the Jews book. But the title, Light Unto the Nations, or Lagoyim, is in Sefer Yeshaya, maybe even one of the Haftarahs, I'm not sure, but it's in Sefer Yeshaya as what we are, Klal Yisrael, or Lagoyim. Here's the second half of that quote, if you're reading the quote. How are we supposed to be our lagoyim if we're so tiny and so hated and persecuted? And we are an outstanding element in the world. For good, for bad, we're always there. You know. I'll tell you, there's a discovery teacher, I'll just digress for one short story for a minute. There's a discovery teacher in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Mati Berger. And he used to live in Baltimore. 30 years ago, in 1987, I'll make the story quick, in Baltimore, he rented out his basement to a Chinese exchange student named Jim Gan. This Jim Gan did not know English. He knew very little about the United States at all. He was an exchange student. And Jim Gan taught himself English by reading the front page of the New York Times every day. I couldn't believe it, but I happen to know personally two people who have done the same thing. One is actually a cousin of mine who lives in Yerushalayim. And the other one is a Russian DBA, database administrator, who worked with me once upon a time in Payne Weber. And they did it the same way. So this Jim Gann in Baltimore, Maryland, in 1987, taught himself English by reading the front page of the New York Times every day. And he kept reading every day about three countries. The United States was always mentioned front page of the Times. The Soviet Union, remember them? We wouldn't say Aleihem HaSholom as a ligand red. The Soviet Union, that was the Russian configuration before, for those people who don't remember Khrushchev and company, I'm telling you about it. And the third nation that was constantly on the front page, Israel. Now, this Jim Gann didn't know anything about Israel. What does he know about Israel? He's from China. He knows as much about Israel like I know about the Reis, Panama. Maybe less. He didn't know where Israel was. But he sees it's an important country. It's every day in the paper. He had a wall map in Marty Berger's basement, and he went looking for Israel on the map. He couldn't find it. Surprise, surprise, huh? Finally, he decided, you know that big country up here, it says Canada? That's Israel. What else could be Israel? You know, countries have two names sometimes. United States, America. United Kingdom, Great Britain. Zaire, Congo. He figured, Canada, Israel. What else could be? There's no other country that he doesn't know. That 3 weeks later, a friend of his says, Jim, I'm going for a vacation. I'm driving up to Montreal. And Jim says to him, oh, have a nice time in Israel. And his friend says, I'm not going to Israel, I'm going to Canada. And Jim says, well, Canada is Israel, yeah? And his friend says, what are you drinking? Meshiga. Canada is Canada, Israel. So Jim Gann says, if Canada is not Israel, show me Israel on the map. So he says, okay, come over here. Canada, U.S., Russia, China. Yeah, you got that now. Come over here, look real close. You see this little country here? It's in green on your map. That's Egypt. You see right next to the green, there's another country even smaller in brown? That's Syria. Now you see in between the green and the brown? Take your finger off. You're covering the whole country. That's Israel. And he says, that's Israel, that little tiny place? There's no room even for the cities in the country. They have to write the name of the city, Tel Aviv, in the ocean with an arrow. That's Israel. He says, that's Israel? How many people could live there? And his friend says, 4 million Jews. This was back in 1987. Baruch Hashem, etc., etc. Now, 4 million Jews in Israel are there on the front page of the newspaper every day? I just read that in my homeland in China, says Jim Gann, there was a census done. And the census said there's 1.2 billion Chinese with a census potential margin of error of 48 million. That's 12 times as many people lost in China than exist in Israel, and they're on the front page of the Times every day. What's going on? That's light unto the nations. That's we are out of proportion. I once mentioned in an office in New York that 22% of Nobel Prize winners are Jewish. Now, might I have a boisai? I'm not saying that's our ultimate goal, to make Nobel Prize winners. Our ultimate goal is to make Yiddish families with Chasen Poiskim, mit Warmkeit, mit Shabbos Kodesh, with everything. But as a side thing, 22% of Nobel Prize winners are Jewish. Yeah?
You can add to that, almost one-third of billionaires are Jewish.
One-third of billionaires are Jewish.
Don't say
I'm in the other two-thirds. I was just checking mentally. 22% of Nobel Prize winners are Jewish. I said it in an office in New York, and somebody actually says to me, yeah, that's all. That's all. You know what percent should be Jewish? Zero. Based on our population, should be zero. How many Eskimos have won the Nobel Prize? Zero. Why? They're frozen? They're normal. They are normal. They are too small a national entity to possibly compete with the world of people. We are basically the same in that regard. And somehow, we're playing a big role. You have a question?
Yes. When you tell this point to not grow people, they usually say that oldest people are not religious. Right. So what do you answer?
Because kind of I never got that statement, but if I would get that statement where somebody would say all these Nobel Prize winners were not religious, I would say that in Eisha Torah's philosophy and in the general philosophy of the Jewish people, we don't judge somebody of who is or who isn't religious. And Judaism is not based on who is or who isn't religious. If you have 10 people that are male over bar mitzvah, they're a minion. even if they're not the most high-class Jews. And if you have nine people who are great Rabban, then they don't put together a minyan. A Yid is a Yid. And in fact, that is the Baal Shem Tov's way of looking at things, and that's the Eish HaTorah way of looking at things. And whatever a chesaron of a Yid has, whether it's a chesaron in Be'olam LaChaveir or a chesaron Be'olam LaMokayim, whatever their averus are, their shortcomings are, in any aspect, they remain a Yid, and as long as they're breathing, they can do tshuva shleima from anything that they did, and they can come closer, and who's to judge somebody else? This is needs to be talked on longer, but God, that's the general idea. Well, I got the biggest applause for something that's not part of the program. What's going on here? Maybe I should digress more. He was planted in the audience with a question, so I should come up with a good answer, right? Shkoyach, shkoyach. Yes?
How would you answer if I would say that 100% of Nobel laureates were city dwellers, and Jews comprise more than 22% of the cities with the great scientific communities?
You're asking me that they're actually the percent is higher in achievements? That just adds to the point.
No.
What do you mean?
Jews as a city dwellers have greater access to education.
Oh, city dwellers?
Right. And
there are possibilities from a sociological standpoints of what causes something. And so nobody can say definitely, is this hereditary, is this inborn, is this educational, is it environmental? But this happens to be a fact.
I would just say there are about 20 million people in Mexico City. I don't know if there's one Nobel Prize winner that was born and raised in Mexico City.
They're working on it. Mexico City is a very nice place, actually, and the Jewish community is very nice, and there's a beautiful kollel there. Since we're being recorded, we don't want to say negative on anybody, and it happens to be a nice place, and I have relatives there. My cousins live in Mexico City. But I don't want to get... We're talking good stuff, but a little bit off of our point, so let's just stick with, so I don't go over the time today... We're looking at a phenomena of what we are. In fact, if I take the phenomena to its ultimate, there's a book called Jewish Mystique, a non-Jewish author, I forgot his name. And he writes, there are four people who have impacted, affected world history the most in the last 250 years. Four people who have lived in the last 250 years who have had the greatest impact on society. None of the four are heads of state. They're citizens. Who do you think they are?
Einstein.
Einstein is right. And Freud is right. And Marx is right. Wow. And the fourth one?
Darwin.
Okay, Darwin wasn't Jewish. Three were right, three were Jewish, one was wrong. But it doesn't matter. Three out of four people are Jewish. We are so tiny a percent. Three out of four people who have affected world history the most are Jewish. That's very weird. Now, to this Olam, us here, Munsi Olam, obviously our role models in Yiddishkeit are not Freud, Marx, and Einstein. Whatever they are, whatever their Olam HaBo is, that's not us to judge, but they're not necessarily our models. In fact, somebody once came over to me after a discovery program with big tightness, with big argument, how can I present these people as heroes? First of all, as I said earlier, who's judging who's a hero, who isn't a hero? Let's just, you know, when it comes to Rosh Chodesh Benchen, Chaim shel Oishav v'chavoyd. And then, Chaim sheyesh bohem yiras shemayim. You know, I was wondering about that. You know, Oishav v'chavoyd, right here. Yiras shemayim bohem, I would check him out. Let me see your tzitzis if they're long enough. Don't look at my tzitzis. No, so we're not judging anybody so right. But I actually developed a class, which I would be happy to present at a different occasion, where I have the four people who I feel have impacted Judaism in the last 200 years. I won't tell you the first three, but the fourth one didn't even wear a yarmulke. Sara Schneer. Okay, let's get back to our subject over here. Somehow we've had this gigantic influence and gigantic input into the world. And there's actually a speech by John Adams that he gave in 1806 about how wonderful the Jewish people are and how fantastic the Jewish people are. And, I mean, if some politician says this today, he's looking for the votes, but I don't think John Adams was looking for the 11 Jewish voters in 1806. The point really, and I'm going to flip the thing because I don't want people reading that instead of listening to me, the point really of this section of the presentation, and I tell it on college campuses too, is not to make you happy and proud that you're a Yid. That's a side thing. No problem with that. I think today if our kids would be happy and proud to be a Yid, and not just a Yid, but a Frum a Yid, the girls, the boys today, the teenagers, and us ourselves, I think that would help us as a community in different ways, but that's not today's subject. The fact of the matter is, though, this presentation is for a different purpose, and it's for the purpose of evidence. The evidence indicates that clearly the Torah is not man-written, because the things that are written are virtually impossible to have happened. But the author of the Torah actually picked the one single nation that defies all the laws of spiritual gravity and picked them and said in detail exactly what's going to be their future. Future that has contradictory elements to it that otherwise shouldn't happen. And we are here, every single person in this room, a living testimony to the accuracy and truth of it, and the first piece of evidence, first section of evidence of the MS of Torah. I want to go without a break into the second part. After my second part, we'll have a break, and Rabbi Yaakov Salomon will continue. The next section is transmission. Going back to our example of verifying documents, we're doing the same thing with our Torah as the Mossad did with the document that they received. And transmission is, how about our transmission process? We're going to focus on Mamad Har Sinai. And I'll make the joke that I make when I do college presentations, even though it'll probably fall flat over here. In college presentations, I say I'm not going to give a big introduction, because even though the next section is the most important section, I don't give an introduction because the first slide is my picture. And then I tell them, don't laugh. And then I show them the picture and they laugh. Here, nobody's going to laugh when they see my picture because it's not me. They think that's Moshe Rabbeinu at Mamad Har Sinai. I know it can't be Moshe Rabbeinu at Mamad Har Sinai. Mamad Har Sinai is on Shavuos. You get a haircut Erev Shavuos. And he didn't get his haircut before Shavuos. It's impossible that's Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's clear raya. You know, Maisa Listar. The fact of the matter is that people have odd concepts of Matan Torah, and the average person out there, not from, doesn't even know exactly any stories about Torah. And they think that all the Matan Torah was Moses was on a mountain and the Jews were dancing around the golden calf, and that's if they know anything. But there's a lot more to it. And I'd actually say for this presentation, instead of playing Martian, you have to try Kaviyochel as much as you could to play what would Hashem's ideas be. I hate to use the term play God because that's as a prosthetic term, but you have to try and look at it from a divine perspective. The Torah actually says the following. Now, of course, this is in English again. Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, Leich Elohim, I'm trying to do it in Lashon Kodesh. V'kidash tam ayom umacho, v'chibsu simlusayim, v'hayu nachaynim layom ha-shlishi, ki v'ayom ha-shlishi yeirein Hashem le'ene kolam al har Sinai. You know, that's Yisrael Perik Yutes, or around there. I know that Pasha, it's my favorite Pasha, it was my Bar Mitzvah Pasha. My cousin a year older than me had Caesarea Metzairah Tulein, my cousin a year younger than me had Caesarea Metzairah Tulein, and I, Baruch Hashem, had Pashas Yisroi Tulein. Those who learn the Torah know that. It's one is 70 psukim, and the other is about 300 psukim, and it says, V'loka Chakoyin 16 times with different thrups. Not important. This is what it actually says in the Torah. And the Torah continues and says that it happened.